Okay, the witching hour is here. Welcome. Today's talk, sponsored by the Science and Technology Policy Program of Ford School. My name is Irv Salmeen. I'm the Associate Director of the program, and Carl Simon, who wears many hats, is coming in later, and he's the Director of the program. If you take a look at the broad question of public policy, you can take it as a solution to a problem. And you always ask yourself what the problem is. And if you grew up in the sciences, as I did starting back in the 60s, you know over the years that there's been this continual roller coaster trying to figure out whether there are enough or too many scientists generally, whether there's enough money or not enough money. And if you take a look at the current U.S. situations, especially with emphasis on technology as a solution to just about all questions, the interesting sidelight to here is where are we going to get the people from? And if you ask the question, how is the federal government funding what and for whom and why, you quickly discover that there are some emerging issues. So today's speaker, Paula Steffen, has composed a book, written a book, created a book, The Economics of Science, which really touches on, I think, some of the critical policy issues with respect to science, its funding, and more important, the scientific manpower question we're going. You have handouts of a bio sketch for Paula, so I'm not going to repeat that. I would ask if you would, if during the talk you have a question for clarification, that's sort of fair game, but I think there's a continuity in the presentation that she would appreciate it if you hold the sort of the broader questions for the end of the talk. And with that, I have nothing else to add. Paula Steffen.
Thanks very much, Irv, for the introduction, and thanks very much for inviting me to come to the Ford School. And I have to say, it's great to be back in Ann Arbor. It's been many, many years since I was here and got my PhD in economics. And I had a wonderful afternoon yesterday walking around the campus and looking at old haunts and thinking about experiences here. So I want to talk to you today about the topic of too many scientists. And just to give you some idea of what my focus is going to be, I want to think about the production and employment of PhDs in the U.S. in the fields of physical sciences, life sciences, and engineering. Those are the fields I want to focus on. I want to look at where they are today, how we got to where we are, what I see as some concerns, and what I see as some possible ways of addressing some of the issues that we face. So just a caveat to begin with, I'm going to talk about PhD education. I'm not going to talk about undergraduate issues or master's programs, and I think those are very different issues. We talked some about that at lunch. And when I talk about too many, I'm talking about too many in terms of supply versus the demand for research positions and using the skill set that one has acquired for research. So a bit of shameless self-promotion here. This is based on a book that I recently wrote called How Economics Shapes Science, and I'd be happy to talk offline about how a mouse made out of a $100 bill got on the cover. So first of all, where are we today in terms of PhD production, postdoc taking, and mechanisms of support? I think those are useful ways to get going. So just in terms of PhD production in engineering, the physical sciences, and the biological sciences, in 2011, the year for which we have just about the most recent data, the U.S. produced about 25,000 PhDs, approximately evenly split between those three broad categories. Where did Michigan stand here? Well, in terms of the number of PhDs produced, Michigan was seventh in engineering with 181. It was eighth in the physical sciences with 133, ninth in the life sciences, 173, and fourth in the social sciences with 117. So this is a chart that shows you PhD production in the United States over approximately a 100-year period. This is really from 1920 to 2011. The early data is taken from administrative records that I got NSF to send me a copy of about 20 years ago. And the most recent data from 1958 on is based on the survey of earned doctorates. And what I really want to show to begin with is in the last 50 years, there's been at least a five-fold increase in the number of PhDs we produce. And in the last 10 years, there's been a huge increase, particularly in engineering and the biological sciences, and we've had an increase of about 43%. Now, we'll talk more about this going down the road. But so between 1961 and 2011, it grew by a factor of five. And between 2001 and 2011, it's grown from 18,000 to almost 26,000, or an increase of 43%. So how are people supported when they're getting a PhD in the United States? So on the survey of earned doctorates, which is a survey I'll refer to a good deal this afternoon, this is a survey that you have to fill out, well, that you're asked to fill out at the time you get your PhD, and it has a very high response rate of over 96%, probably because people think you got to fill it out to get your degree. I sure did when Rackham handed me this form years and years ago. So one of the questions on it is, what was your primary source of support? So I thought it was interesting to break this down, physical sciences, engineering, and the life sciences. And this is the way NSF shows the data. And unfortunately, they put research assistantship and training grant data together in this aggregated data. But you see in the physical sciences, blue is teaching assistants. So slightly fewer than 30% say a teaching assistant was their largest source. Research assistants or training is about 45%, and other forms are considerably less. In engineering, we have a huge percent who are being supported as RAs primarily. And we have both people on fellowships and in research assistant positions in the life sciences. Now, this life science category by NIH, by NSF, is now a little deceptive because the way they changed their aggregate data, they put the health sciences in with
The biological sciences. So when we look at their most recent data, it includes PhDs in nursing and physical therapy, et cetera. So if you just look at the biomedical sciences and look at data that NIH has put together,
we find that graduate students are three times more likely to be supported as research assistants. So this is some data we put together for the NIH Workforce Committee that I participated in the subcommittee, and look at what we have in the basic biomedical sciences. The number of doctoral students supported as graduate research assistants is about 25,000, and the number supported on training grants is about 5,000, with the number on fellowships as being fairly low also. So we've also had a tremendous increase in the number of postdocs working in the United States. This data is from 1980 to 2010, and you see that it's grown by threefold during this period. And one of the things I have to say is that we have just really terrible data on the number of postdocs we have working in the U.S., and that's because of, for a couple of reasons. One, the way we collect the data, and two, the fact that at many, many campuses now in the U.S., there are very creative titles for people who are in postdoc positions, and that's partly because a report 10 years ago recommended that people only be a postdoc for 5 years. So if you recommend you only be a postdoc for 5 years, of course the system adapts and we find new names for people who are doing approximately that thing. And so it's very, very hard to get good data on postdocs, but we know there are a lot. And we know there are at least 60,000. Right now, I'm on the committee to reconsider the postdoc position. It's a National Academy committee. And this is one of the questions we're grappling with, is just how many there are. This shows you postdocs by field. And what you see is how heavily dominated it is by people in the life sciences. It's grown tremendously. It grew a lot during the NIH doubling. But you also see a lot of people in the physical sciences, which is the blue down here. And in, in the physical sciences, which is the green, and I'll talk a little bit more about this. There's been a big increase in the number of postdocs in engineering in recent years, just a significant increase. So how did we get to where we are today? Well,
I think it's fair to say that science emerged pretty triumphant from World War II. It contributed radar and the Manhattan Project to the success of the war. It contributed penicillin, and if you look at the death rate among people in the army, in World War I, it was 14.1 per thousand, and in World War II, it was 0.6 per thousand, a huge decline. And beyond penicillin, there were a number of other medical breakthroughs that really contributed to the health and safety of soldiers and the population. And it's fair to say that public officials and the public were duly impressed with science at this period. As one researcher at NIH said in a 1948 document, that from the end of the war on, science was spelled with a capital S and research with a capital R. And probably nobody appreciated this more than Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush was Roosevelt's scientific advisor during the war. And as the war came to an end, Vannevar Bush positioned and finagled to get Roosevelt to write him a letter asking him to write a report about how the U.S. should move forward in terms of funding research and basic research. And so in a period of 6 months, Vannevar Bush authored Science, the Endless Frontier. He had a group of people helping him do research in this. One of them, as a just ending graduate school, was the economist Paul Samuelson, who was on one of the teams. So this report sets out the role for the federal government in supporting research and training. Now, it's important to realize just what a shift was about ready to happen. It's estimated that in 1940, at universities and medical schools in the U.S., we were spending $31 million on research. In today's dollars, that translates into about $500 million, or less than 1% of what we're spending on research at universities today. And where did that $31 million come from? Well, it came from endowments, private foundations, and donations, not from the federal government. It's not on the list. So what were the objectives of the Endless Frontier? Well, there really were two main objectives relevant to universities. The first objective was to promote basic research. At universities and institutes, by providing funding for research. And there's some interesting quotes in the report, which if you haven't read it, it's always worth looking at it, that Bush thought universities were the right place because they were the least under pressure for immediate tangible results. The related goal was to build up less strong departments at medical schools and universities. At the time the Endless Frontier was written, Bush estimated that there were 5 to 10 at most research medical schools in the United States. Most medical schools did no research. Stanford is a really interesting example. The medical school was in San Francisco. It was almost 100% staffed by part-time clinicians, and they were doing virtually no research at that time. It's also estimated that, depending on how you count them, there were at most 15 research universities in the United States at this time. So the second objective of the Endless Frontier was to address the deficit in the number of trained researchers. And Bush really believed that we had a deficit and that we needed to train more people to do research down the road. And he wanted to train them by giving them support. If you were a graduate student or an MD student, he believed the proper form of support was a fellowship. And if you were an undergraduate, he wanted to give you a scholarship. And I think it's very interesting to note that nowhere, you read all the fine print, there's nothing about the concept of graduate research assistant in this report. We need to support research and we need to support students so that we'll have future researchers. And just to go back to this diagram, you can see the deficit that Bush was really worried about. PhD programs in the U.S. had grown a little in the 1920s and 30s, and then as the war began, they had really begun, for obvious reasons, production of PhDs had declined considerably. And by the end of the war, we were producing very few PhDs. And we didn't have that many programs producing PhDs in fields. In the life sciences and in chemistry, there were about 60 programs. And in the other disciplines, there were approximately 50 PhD programs in the United States. And the majority of PhDs were produced by about 12 institutions in the United States. So how was this to be implemented? Well, it was to be implemented, according to Bush, by substantially increasing NIH's budget and by developing a National Research Foundation, which became the genesis of NSF. So let's look at the early years. For the last year, because I perhaps unwisely agreed to write a paper for an NBER volume celebrating 70 years of the endless frontier, I went back and tried to find historic documents looking at what NIH and NSF was doing in training in the late 40s in the case of NIH, and for the case of NSF in the 50s to late 50s. And it was a very interesting read. So if you go to NIH records, we find that the shortage of talent was seen as a bottleneck to getting the research done. Mary Munger wrote a history of the first 12 years of NIH, and she says, from the beginning of the extramural research grants program, the lack of a sufficient number of qualified research investigators was a continued bottleneck. So NIH initially started awarding fellowships for both medical school and for PhD study, and at some time in the 50s, they began to feel that it was difficult for them to make all the decisions, and the idea of training grants began to evolve. Now, at NSF, as most of you know, as part of the Act, they established the Division of Scientific Personnel and Education, and they were given the authority to award fellowships. And so from the very beginning, NSF was awarding fellowships of 500 to 600 a year. And at the same time, program officers at NSF began to entertain faculty grants that included a graduate student or a postdoc on them. And so we began to see, if you look through NSF documents, that people began to ask for graduate research assistantships on their grants and get them funded. There's very little data available on exactly, or any longitudinal data that I can find, as to how we supported people over a period of time. But there is one nice study done in 1966 for the National Science Board by agency. These agencies are the Atomic Energy Commission, NASA, the National Education and Defense Act, public health, which is basically NIH and NSF. And these are the kinds of support they outlined that was being awarded. And you notice in terms of research assistantships, the Atomic Energy Commission, the bulk of its support to graduate students was going as graduate research assistants. A considerable amount of NSF funding for graduate students went as graduate research assistantships. In terms of training grants, we had a large number from public health, that's NIH training grants, and of course, and from NASA, which is interesting. And in fellowships, it's good that it shows up. The National Education Defense Act, that was primarily in the business of awarding fellowships, was really spending most of its money on graduate students as fellowships. If you look at data that's just a little later for NIH, we see that over time, the percent of graduate students that NIH has supported on training grants has stayed quite constant, while the number that they're supporting as graduate research assistants has gone up and really went up towards the end of the doubling. So I think one can really argue that a change in research practices had really begun. We were staffing labs with graduate students and postdocs, and that had become to be the underlying model for university research. And we also began to use graduate students to teach introductory courses, particularly in physics and in chemistry. So I think one can argue that by the late 60s, training had become less about future supply that Bush thought it was going to be about, and more about getting the research and teaching done now. And it's not surprising that we see time to degree increasing during this period. In 1958 to 1960, the average time to degree across broad field is about 5 years. And you see, regardless of field, we see it increasing throughout the 80s and 90s until it peaks at close to 7 years and then begins to decline just a little bit. It's also important to notice that international PhD programs became much more, that graduate programs in the United States became much more international during this period, and that postdoctoral positions became much more international. So this just shows you the composition of PhDs by citizenship status. Yellow is temporary, red is permanent residence, and the black line is the percent on who are temporary residents. Don't worry about this big dip here. It's the Chinese Student Protection Act, where people who were temporary residents from China could become permanent residents, and that's why the line goes down so much. But you see basically an increase over time, and that we've gotten to a point of temporary residents make up about 42 to 43% of all PhDs in these fields. And if you include permanent residents, it gets closer to 50%. Now, fields vary a great deal in terms of their composition, their international composition. The lighter colors in all of these are foreign, and by foreign, I mean people on temporary visas. So we see that the field that has the largest percent of foreign students is engineering. That's well over 50% and has been for quite a while. That math and computer science have a huge component of foreign students, and that the physical sciences do. And the biomedical sciences, biological sciences have increased over, well, here it's coded as life sciences. We've seen an increase, but the increase hasn't been nearly as great as in other fields. Currently, about 23% of PhDs awarded in the life sciences go to foreign students. And it's important to know that foreign students show different patterns of support for graduate students than citizens and permanent residents. So this breaks it down by field. This is physical sciences and life sciences. And here we see teaching assistants. Well, foreign students are more, they're the blue. They're more likely to be teaching assistants than citizens. They're more likely to be RAs than citizens in the physical sciences. In the life sciences, we see that they're more likely to be research assistants and less likely to be on fellowships. And when we get to engineering, we see that the people on temporary visas are overwhelmingly graduate research assistants and are very likely and are also teaching assistants compared to citizens. And it's also interesting that we have a number of people in PhD programs in the U.S. that are paid for by their company where they used to work to get a PhD, and there's a huge citizenship difference there. Citizens, 7% are being paid by their company, and less than 0.5% of the foreign-born.
In terms of postdocs, beginning in the mid-1990s, the percent who were here as temporary residents began to be greater than the percent that are U.S. citizens, although after some crackdown in visas after 9/11, we see a little bit of a slowing. This shows you for the last 10 years visa status by field of postdocs, and we see that a very large part of the life sciences are foreign-born postdocs, and that a large percent of the postdocs in engineering, a large portion of them are foreign-born. It's also interesting to know the PhD origins of postdocs working in the U.S. 5 out of 10 postdocs working in academia in the U.S. earned their doctorate outside the U.S. In other words, they came here with PhD in hand to become a postdoc, and one person estimates that 4 out of 5 postdocs who are here as a on a temporary visa got their PhD outside the U.S. So it's a big port of entry for people. So just to summarize, there have been 2 major shifts I think you can think about. One is the type of support for graduate study and postdoctoral study. It used to be more about building a future supply, and now it's about getting research done now.
And at the same time, the composition
of the doctoral educated pool has been changing to be more and to have an increasing number of temporary residents in it. So that's kind of the overview I want to give, and now I'd like to really focus on incentives and costs that I think have really led to these changes. So in terms of incentives,
I think that there are at least three things that have really contributed to these trends. First, research has become increasingly specialized. Secondly, funding for research has become increasingly important. And third, and very related, publications have become more important. They're a necessary condition for getting funding and a necessary condition for continuing one's funding. So in terms of specialization, I mean, just as a sign of this, a co-authored article is now truly the dinosaur, that we know that the average number of authors on a paper has just about doubled over a period of time. And we know that what this really shows is that specialization has become increasingly important in doing research. And specialization means that faculty increasingly are looking for people to work with them on research and to help staff their labs who bring different skills. Now, it's also true that external funding has become increasingly important to universities. And in some way, I think you can argue that universities in many ways have become or have adopted what you might think of as a high-end shopping mall model. And what I mean by that is that universities are in the business of building state-of-the-art facilities and the reputation that attracts good students, good faculties, and good resources, that they turn around in some sense and lease these facilities to faculty in the form of indirect cost, and faculty pay in some sense for the opportunity of working at the university by writing off part of their salary on grants. And those in soft money positions really have no guarantee that they'll be able to continue if they fail to bring in grants. So this means that faculty are under considerable pressure to bring in grants. Universities provide startup packages of anywhere from $500,000 to $600,000 to a couple of $1 million, depending upon your rank and your field. And these provide you with equipment and funds for graduate students or postdocs and supplies for the first couple of years. But after that, you're really on your own to bring in, to cover these costs. And it's very hard to get tenure and promoted at a university, at a research university, without bringing in grants. And the pressure, as I said, is even greater if you're in a soft money position. Stephen Quake, who's a biophysicist, has said that for these people, it's funding or famine. It's no longer publish or perish, it's funding or famine. And also, and we talked a little bit about this at dinner last night, in medical schools in the United States, tenure is simply not equivalent to having a salary-backed position. In the majority of medical schools that have tenure, your salary is not guaranteed if you don't bring in a grant. It's estimated, or I've heard estimates from faculty in the medical school at Harvard, that the tenured people there are writing off 95% of their salary on grants. So at the same time that we have all of this pressure, funding is in short supply and competition for grants has become much more intense. So this is data that I've pieced together, and it's quite patchy in some places, for success rates at NIH, which is blue, and for NSF, which is red. And we see generally, and they're missing years in here, you'll have to see, but we see generally in recent years a tremendous downward decline, except this is NSF with ARRA funds right here, and when NSF got a little bit more before that. So it's become increasingly difficult to get funds. The focus on grant seeking really raises the importance of having other people work in your lab. I mean, one survey estimates that 42% of a faculty member's time in research is spent on grant administration. So you're taking a lot of time to bring in grants and administer the grants. It raises the importance of having other people to work in your lab. And, of course, you've got to have publications coming out because publications play a huge role at the time of grant review. So these forces of specialization, funding, and the need to and increased pressures to publish really lead principal investigators to seek clever individuals to staff their labs.
You know, there are really three groups of people, in some sense, that you can choose from. You can choose from graduate students, postdocs, or staff scientists, research scientists positions. And I think this is where costs really play a huge role. So what's the cost of a graduate student? Well, the stipend varies between around $16,000 to $28,000, and it can cost an additional $16,000 for tuition. It depends on a university's practices. There was a survey of Big Ten institutions in 2004, and it found that the median full cost, exclusive of indirect, of a graduate research assistant was $29,000. This is across fields, but the high end was $48,000 and the low was $17,000. GRAs can work approximately 1,200 hours a year to 1,500, and this suggests that the low end, their hourly wage is somewhere about a little bit less than $13 an hour, around $21.50 at the median and $35.50. So what about postdocs? Well, the NIH current stipulated rate is $39,264 for an NRSA first-year postdoctoral scholar, and most institutions follow this, and many institutions follow it for other people outside the biomedical sciences. So I went to the survey of doctorate recipients and found that the average postdoc reported working 2,650 hours a year in the life and physical sciences, and a little bit less in engineering and a little bit less in math. So that means that the hourly rate before fringes is just slightly less than $15 an hour in the biomedical sciences. And if we add a small dose of fringes on, and you have to remember that at a lot of campuses, postdocs do not qualify for fringe benefits, we're talking about around $18 an hour. And there's some variation in cost. I was at the American Chemical Society's launch of its new recommendations for graduate training 10 days ago, and at the dinner table, somebody at an institution that won't be named reported that people at his institution and in his department were hiring, bringing in postdocs and paying them $20,000 a year, and that it was not being monitored in any way by his institution. So which would you choose? The staff scientist costs around $31.75 an hour at a minimum, the postdoc about $18 per hour, and the graduate student between $12.60 to $37, depending upon where you are. Well, I think that very quickly one sees that the cost advantage, depending upon your campus, but it really lies with graduate students and with postdocs. So it's no surprise that labs in the United States look a lot like this. This is Alex Pine's lab at Berkeley, but we could have similar pictures from most people's labs. And just for fun, I put up Christina White's lab. She's a chemist at Illinois, and she likes to keep this picture on her webpage. And you'll spot a couple of celebrities that she's snuck into this picture, okay? But the point is that generally the people in these labs are young and their postdocs are graduate students. We see this if we look at authorship patterns. I studied papers published in the journal Science, and I looked at papers that had a US lab as the home lab, and then I studied papers that had 10 or fewer authors, and among all authors, 44% were graduate students or postdocs or students that I couldn't classify. And then when you look at first author, or generally the author who does the heavy lifting, 74% were either postdocs or graduate students or students I couldn't classify. So this raises what I want to kind of
topic I want to now focus on.
Do we have too many?
Well, when I talk about too many, I'm talking about training relative to demand.
And I think that one can say, can argue that in many
fields, the U.S. is producing more PhDs
than the market for research positions demands, given current levels and what look like future levels for research funding. Okay? Now, part of this is undoubtedly cyclical. But in the field of biomedical sciences, I really think it's chronic, and I think it's been so at least since 1976. You can find a National Research Council report going back as early as 1976 that concluded that we needed a slower rate of growth in the labor force in these fields was advisable because people were having a difficult time finding jobs. So I think incentives encourage this. Graduate students, as I've said, are temporary. They've got a lot of fresh ideas and they're reasonably cheap. So I argue in the book, and I've argued elsewhere, that in many ways, of course, our labs at universities look like a pyramid, and in some ways they resemble a pyramid scheme in which we have a principal investigator with staff scientists, postdocs, and graduate students, and in some labs, undergraduate students. And this way of structuring our research works reasonably well if the system is really growing and we have lots and lots of resources coming in. But increasingly, this has not been true, and it's become increasingly difficult for young researchers to find independent research positions in academia, government, or industry. So let me just show you some evidence concerning this. One piece of evidence comes from the Survey of Earned Doctorates, and it asks you at the time you got your PhD, do you have a definite commitment for a job? Okay? So this is the most recent data we have, and it's from 1991 to 2011. And you see there's considerable variation. This is for the social sciences in blue, physical in yellow, engineering in green, and life sciences in red. But what we see is that particularly in recent years, there's been a decidedly downward trend in the percent that have definite commitments. And in the life sciences, it's fallen from around 73% to about 63%. In the other fields, it's gone down by about 5 percentage points. And then the interesting question is, you ask these people, okay, you have a definite commitment. What's the definite commitment for? Almost increasingly, it's for a postdoctoral position.
Okay?
So look at, this is the people who have definite commitments, the percent that are going into a postdoctoral position. In the life sciences, it's now at about 70%. In the physical sciences, it's been up to about 60%. And you'll notice that there's been, that there had been a big increase in engineering. And just so you can focus on the last 10 years, this is what we see. And one of the things, unfortunately, the colors changed here, but look at engineering that was as low as 20% in 2001 and went up to 45% at the height of ARRA funding and has now dropped a little, I think, partly because the ARRA funding ran out and there's not money for these postdocs. And you see a significant increase in the life sciences and somewhat of an increase in the physical sciences. Or take a survey that the American Institute of Physics did of PhDs graduated in 2009 and 2010. 1,550 PhDs were given in physics. 84% remained in the U.S. 59% of them had a postdoc position, okay? 29% thought they had a job that had the likelihood of being permanent. 7% said temporary and 4% said they were unemployed and 1% out of the labor force. And then if you ask the people who are in postdoc positions, why do you have a postdoc? In 2007, 7% said it's because they couldn't find something else. And in this recent survey, it was 13%. Or here's data that Anita Jones collected for computer science departments to look at what's happening in academe and computer science departments across the U.S. in terms of hiring, and the purple line was tenure track positions, and hiring completely peaked in 2004 in tenure track positions, and the only type of position that has grown has been postdoc positions. I mean, this is a small number of positions, but it's quite an increase in trend. For the Biomedical Workforce Committee at NIH, we tried to put together cohort data coming from the survey of doctorate recipients. So we put together data from 1993 to 2008, and this is the cohort that had been out 1 to 5 years. In other words, these people got their PhDs in 1993. They had gotten their PhD 1 to 5 years before that. In 2008, they had gotten their degrees 1 to 5 years before 2008. And this is the 6 to 10 year cohort, the 11 to 20 year cohort, and the above 20 year cohort.
And two trends really stand out on this. Red is the percent of the cohort who's in a tenure track position, and we see regardless of cohort, red's going down, right, over time. And then the other thing that stands out is that green is really going up, and those are non-academic, non-research positions. People who are not working in a university sector and say that they are not doing research. So the American Chemical Society, as I said, just issued this report, Advancing Graduate Education in the Chemical Sciences. They released it last spring. They just had this meeting to launch its recommendations. And when you ask them what triggered your doing this report, they said that the incredible downturn they've seen in placements in industry have really triggered it, and that they don't see it as cyclical. They see part of it as a really fundamental shift in the U.S. economy and the world economy in terms of how we're structuring research positions and what's going on in industry. So I've talked briefly about the incentives for universities to hire graduate students and postdocs, so we could just briefly talk about why students do it, because, I mean, this is in some sense a market, and we don't just have people who are hiring them. I think people do it because they have an interest in science, they have aspirations of becoming a scientist, they have information, or really a lack of information, and for international students, it's all of the above, plus study in the U.S. really provides a visa option. And John Bound, who's in the, sitting out there, has done some work on that. So in terms of interest and aspirations, you know, if you have an interest in solving puzzles, if you like to do science, and somebody comes to you and says, we can support you while you're in graduate school, you don't have to pay tuition, you get a stipend, it seems like an appealing thing to do. And faculty are pretty good salesmen. And sometimes, as David Levitt says, there's no honesty at all in recruiting PhD students. There's not a hint. There's a shortage of jobs. And one thing that's true, and probably true of most of us, is we overassess our chances. So Henry Sauerman and Mike Roach fielded this wonderful survey of PhD and postdoc students in 39 departments across three disciplines. And they asked them, are you better than your peers in this program? And what do you think? The majority of them think they're significantly better than their peers. And then we've created this postdoc position. So you can say, oh, you don't have to worry. There's a postdoc position waiting for you out there. And information is really in short supply. Many students really get very minimal amount of information. I went to 45 websites for 15 programs in electrical engineering, chemistry, and the biomedical sciences in 2008, and I found that only two of those programs gave any placement advice on their website. And why do people take a postdoc position? Well, for those kind of reasons, but it's readily available. They've told it was the next step. And they really haven't explored other opportunities while they're in graduate school, and they don't have a lot of opportunities elsewhere. So what's the concern? Why should we be concerned about this? Well, first of all, I think there are at least two concerns. It results in a large group of disenchanted young researchers, and there are a lot of disenchanted researchers out there. And I think that we have to worry about that because it discourages future talented students, particularly domestic students, from choosing a career in science. But also, it's socially inefficient because we as society and students themselves have invested a considerable amount in creating skills that really have a high probability of not being used. I estimate that during a three-year postdoc, a scientist gives up more than $60,000 in foregone earnings. It's a significant amount being foregone. So I think I'll skip that in the interest of time. So what can we do about it? Well, first of all, I think it's really important to increase transparency. We have a graduate programs right now in which there hasn't been a lot of transparency. We need to make information regarding career outcomes readily available at the department level and at the discipline level. I think we have to provide incentives to departments and PIs to do this. I've been arguing on the NIH
and NRC committees I'm on that this should be an element of grant review. We require it for training grants. We have to look at outcome data. We should look at outcome data when we're thinking about renewing somebody's NIH 01 grant. What's happened to the people who've been working with them? In the long run, I'm very hopeful that we can link this data on students to the LEHD data at census centers behind firewalls and get really good data on where students end up working. But that will be a while down the road. I think we need to help students explore their options. I really think we got a lot of people in PhD programs and a lot of the people I talk to who say that they really realized a little too late that the PhD wasn't really for them, but they went ahead and finished. I think we need to figure out how to help people figure out if a PhD is for them, and we need to hopefully help have them have that conversation before. We're often so busy selling them PhD programs that we don't talk to them about whether it's a good fit for them. And if it's not for them, need to help them find out master's programs or other kind of programs that will serve them well. I think we have a real incentive problem at NIH in that graduate research assistantship positions are much more appealing to universities in some ways than training grants just financially. And that's because training grants still carry that old NIH indirect rate of 8%, and there are caps on how much you can charge off, so universities are losing about $12,000 that way. Research assistant positions have more flexibility in them in terms of NIH categories, and a lot of faculty would like RAs rather than training grants. Now, despite the fact that everybody that you talk to offline thinks training grants are great, I've been on two committees that have recommended that NIH go forward with more training grants, and in both instances, in our 1998 recommendation and our 2012 recommendation, NIH says that's something we're not going to do anything about. I think that it would be good to put more money into fellowships. I think it empowers students to shop, for students to go out and interview programs and interview faculty and make a good match to begin with. Some people would advocate cost sharing with students, require students to have a little bit of skin in the game. I should say that they already have some skin in the game because graduate research assistantships pay a lot less than what people could be earning right after they get out of college. I went online last night to give you that figure, but I got when I hooked in the message that the U.S. government was shut down, so I couldn't bring you that number, okay? And I think we need to hire more staff scientists and provide incentives for hiring more staff scientists. And maybe one way to do that will become perhaps just a little bit more obvious in just a second. I think it's really important. If universities can't figure this out themselves, then I think we need, as a society, to lessen the coupling between research and training. Effective training really requires a research environment. Absolutely. Everyone's agreed to that. But you can do effective research outside a training environment. And I think we need, at the margin, to encourage the establishment of more research institutes that are independent from universities. As I say in the book, abstinence, after all, is the most effective form of birth control. These institutes would not be able, they're not in the education business. I think, and we made this recommendation in the NIH workforce report, that we need to limit the amount of faculty time charged off grants. We have one of the things that's really quite sobering is everybody thinks a very large percent of salaries are charged off grants, but at NIH they cannot tell you what percent is being charged off grants. We just don't have the data to do that. In our workforce report for NIH, we put in this recommendation, and it's one of the other recommendations that NIH has chosen not to act on. But I think that if we did this, it would really discourage universities from expanding on soft money positions, or as I think the time has really come, as Princeton Shirley Tillman says, to have a conversation between the government and research universities on how to live in a steady state. So my postdoctoral recommendations that I'll close with are very much like those for PhDs, because one of the reasons we have so many postdocs is we're training a lot of PhDs that don't know where to go when they get there. So we need to think about those things. But we also need to cut back on the demand for postdocs by raising the salary that we pay postdocs. I think that the evidence is very, very strong that relative to the skill set and what they're doing, postdocs are underpaid. And if you just look at census data, you'll find that in 2011, the median person in the United States who's been out of college 7 to 8 years and who does not have any training beyond an undergraduate degree is earning $47,750, okay? And we're paying postdocs at $39,000, okay? And why do I think this is important? Well, many people think it's because it's fair, but what, as an economist, it says to me is, this is a market signal that we need to change the system. And if we raise the price of postdocs, we will really make it clearer that there are issues here, and it will encourage also universities to move more into hiring staff scientists. I also think, and being on this postdoc committee, you keep hearing reports of institutions that don't monitor at all what's happening in some of the labs at their institutions, and I think that's something we definitely need to get more control over, and I would hope that we can make changes there. So, just to conclude, I think it's very important to take note that more funding would help, but it doesn't address some of the underlying kind of positive feedbacks that the system has, where we increase funding and that's accompanied by increased training, which is accompanied by increased demand for funding. It's become a very, very unstable system that we have. So I really think that we need to address the incentives that have allowed the system to evolve to its current situation. So just by way of concluding, I think that there's a considerable indication that we are currently training more PhDs in many fields than can be employed in research positions. I think in some fields, in many fields, a lot of this is cyclical, but I also point out that a lot of these trends existed before the Great Depression that occurred in 2008 and 2009. But in the biomedical sciences, I think it's really been systemic and has been so for at least 35 years. So we need, once again, to make training more about future supply and less about getting the research done now. So I'll stop there and open it up for discussion and comments, questions. Let's see, Carl, how do you want to do this?
So I think the easiest way is to put up a hand and
Lindsay will come. Oh, great.
Hi.
Hey, John.
I'm sold.
You're sold.
I'm sold, except I'm not.
And right.
This is what surprises me, or I don't understand, and which is why does domestic students keep coming, showing up?
Why the
domestic student? Why the domestic student?
Domestic students keep coming.
Because the university doesn't have to tell you that those PhDs didn't get jobs. You see it, at least in our PhD program, which is not in the science. I mean, I'll call it not in the sciences. The students are very aware about what is happening. And even in incoming classes, as we compete for graduate students, one of the dimensions in which we have to compete for graduate students is by telling them about placement. So we now keep placement records. We tell people about how our students are doing. They compare us to the University of Wisconsin or wherever else it happens. There seems to me the way to rationalize what you're saying is is a complete information failure. But that's something that at some level it's hard to understand. And if you go back, for example, to Freeman's work on college graduates, people sort of thought, well, the college graduates don't have any information about their prospects after you get finished college. And then his PhD thesis was that they seem to be responding to the incentives. They must have that information.
Right. But
so this kind of just...
So I think it's a great question. And first of all, I have to say that when I did those 45 departments I talked about, I also did 15 economics departments, okay? And 12 out of the 15 economics departments had placement data right on their webpage. So, you know, it's really a tradition in our field and has been for a number of years to put your placement data right out there.
Oh,
it's completely demand-driven. So, I mean, I think it's very much demand-driven. So I think it's very interesting question. Why it's not more demand in science. And I think there are a couple of reasons here, okay? I think that one thing is that people are a little bit more cognizant of opportunity cost and that they have alternatives. I think a lot of people, and that's why I tried to put up why do students do it, you know, I think this is very important. I think a lot of people who go into science, very few people go into science because of the money, okay? Initially, I think. It's just not a driver as to why they go in. And I think people really have more of an interest in doing the research. And I think science curriculums don't encourage people to ask those questions. Now, why the word doesn't spread as it's really begun to spread? And you remember Richard's thesis was looking at physics when the physics market just completely collapsed, right? It didn't collapse by 10%. I mean, it just tanked. So students pick up something that completely tanked, okay? But it's not as nearly as clear that at these kind of margins that people in science have picked it up, all right? And it's amazing the number of students who will suggest that that they didn't, we're not at all fully cognizant of their, and there have been several people shaking their heads when you said that. One person behind you, one here, so let's hear from them, okay?
I think there's also a sampling bias in the sense that students go to a university where they're in classes of PhDs that have jobs, and therefore they say, well, all the PhDs I know have jobs and their jobs look pretty cool. Therefore, it must be easy to get a good job with a PhD. And I think a lot of people don't go beyond that. But in economics, I'm sure they're a little bit more savvy in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Biology, no.
I'm not quite counter to this. Uh-huh. Maybe it relates to your one thing. Uh-huh. Totally off the cliff.
Right.
My first PhD program, because of whatever, it was in philosophy. Now, not a great demand. And they were even, at that time, kind of advertised, you know, as you went in, made up. But it's clear to me the students in the philosophy program, which is at Berkeley, had gotten the word.
Right.
And it wasn't, we weren't going into this field because we thought we were going to earn big bucks.
You did.
What?
You did go to the field and didn't make big bucks.
My second field, my fourth field, whatever. But still the market were, I mean, the market signals were there. I mean,
right.
In some sense that you weren't going to be able to get a job. So the 13 people who started my PhD program, all but three were left at the end. I had left the program by the end of the first year.
I think at the risk of being maybe a little intrusive here, I think I saw some other hands. And so maybe you could have this conversation offline.
I was just wondering if you could comment on sort of a rhetorical and maybe policy push for these STEM positions that I think is sort of pervasive in the media, and I think adds to this illusion that there are positions available for people who have an interest in the sciences.
Well, I think that's a very good comment. And first of all, I think that the question of STEM education at the high school and college level, that there's nobody out there, or at least me, who's suggesting that we don't need to encourage that, okay? Because we clearly need an educated workforce that understands these kinds of things, and we have some pretty serious failings in this in the U.S. But I also think, and Michael Teitelbaum will be publishing a book on this later, well, early next year, that I think there has been a real vested interest, particularly in the IT industry, particularly to lobby to say that there's been a shortage. And there's also been, and I talk some about it in the book, and Michael talks a lot about it in his upcoming book, there has been incentives by government agencies, including NSF, to predict that we're going to have a shortage because they think it's a great way to get funding. And we've kind of yelled wolf, wolf just a few too many times here. And I think that that's, there's lots of not good credibility there. There's a great report, an NRC report by that was chaired by Dan McFadden, who ended up winning the Nobel Prize in Economics, and it really looks into the pitfalls of forecasting these kinds of markets and really pulls apart a lot of those predictions that we would have shortages. Okay.
Former student Sasha Kilowald and I wrote a book that was published
right.
in the same year.
Unfortunately, we didn't know
each other's book. We didn't sign each other. But we also address similar issues. We look at same data. So on the data issue, we have almost no agreement, no disagreement. On interpretation, I take John's point. We didn't take a strong position on this issue. We were quite conservative, in part because it's such a complicated issue. I'll just give you two things out. We did talk about international competition. After we published a book, I actually started to work on a project on science in China. So we would like to go back to the 50s. We cannot. The world has changed. The world will not allow us to go back to the 50s. We had best in science, manufacturing, electronics. Those things are gone. Those days of American dominance in the world is probably no longer. So we are living in a different era now than used to be. China used to be have less than 1%, 0.5% of college-educated population. Now produces, in proportion-wise, as many bachelor's degree, one quarter with bachelor's degrees as in U.S., same rate as U.S. It produces far more bachelor's degrees in science and engineering, four times as many as U.S. The world has changed. If you look at publications data, either in total number of publications or the share of publications that are most cited, all other countries have gone up, except the U.S.
Right.
U.S.
Right.
has come down. So those concerned with the well-being of science in the U.S. are correcting that the rest of the world is catching up, is surpassing. If the trend continues, we are no longer to be dominant. Maybe that's not important, but policymakers are concerned. Scientists are concerned. I cannot tell them you shouldn't be concerned because the trend is not in U.S. favor. Things that happen to auto industry, steel industry, and many other industries, electronics industry, could happen to science as well. We are gradually losing leadership if the trend continues. So that's one concern. Another concern is that even though a lot of PhDs, postdocs do not end up like John Bond, Michigan, a top scholar or being paid a high rate, on the other hand, you cannot, economists, the more supply or potential base cannot hurt if you want end product because you have a large base, you have more selection, you have stronger criteria, and you can have higher standard, you have a larger pool to choose from. So in the end, there is probably improvement in quality, both not just in terms of lab assistance, the labor input, of course, leads to output. That's that one. One measure of quality, you may improve American science quality by input, labor input, but also you also are able to recruit top scholars. You have a larger base to choose from. So
I would just make two comments to that. And I love your book, and I like your work a great deal. And what I think, though, there are two things that I would disagree with. One is that one thing that hasn't changed is we're still doing university research the way we were doing university research in the 80s and 90s. I mean, you know, we think that these labs should be staffed by graduate students and postdocs. And maybe there's a better way to do it. And we have not had any incentives or been encouraged to think of alternative ways of doing that. And that's because the system has pretty much been controlled by us, because we're the people who make decisions at NIH and NSF and at other agencies. So that's one of it. And selection, yes, selection's a good thing, but there's a huge social cost to some of the selection that's going on today. And there is a huge pool of people now out there who will not ever have a job that draws on these skills. And one of the quotes that I didn't have time to go through was the last NRSA report suggested, well, you know, we have a great research system and it's great to have postdocs and graduate students for this research system. And if they can't find jobs, let's turn them into middle school teachers and high school teachers. Well, that is an incredibly inefficient way to have somebody be in a PhD program for 5 to 7 years and a postdoc position for 5 years to turn them into a secondary school teacher or a middle school teacher. They may not have the skill set to do it. And furthermore, when you talk to people, most boards of education don't have a salary position for them and won't interview them, so they're turned away. So a lot of people find that they're overqualified and just poorly fit. So I think that's a big social cost in our system. Uh-huh. Hey, Sally.
Hey. Okay. I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm a department chair in human genetics over in the medical school. And I wanted to give a few comments because I spent a lot of time working last year on doing a survey of graduates of our PhD programs in the medical school. So we looked at 6 of our different PhD programs and looked in the past 5 years, people that graduated 5 years ago and people that graduated 10 years ago, to see if there was a difference in the type of jobs that they were getting, how many were going to do postdocs, and how long they were in the postdocs. And in our cohort that we looked at, we were doing much better than the benchmarks in the Tillman-Rocky report. And we saw no difference between the past 5 years and the previous 5 years.
That's great.
And I guess from that, I wonder whether with the NIH funds shrinking and a lot of biomedical research depending on these large clinical translational science awards, that we may see a trend towards research PhD training taking place in the top, very top tier, more elite universities. And the other thing I wanted to mention is looking at where students are placed in the biomedical sciences from our program. So Kate can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we started our umbrella program where we worked together mm-hmm. with all the PhD recruits, and then they've specialized in different fields about 15 years ago. And we had a 10-year reunion of our very first combined class, and many were in what traditionally would be called oblique careers relative to what you would expect for PhD training. And it was really interesting to hear from them how their PhD, they felt their PhD contributed to getting their current non-traditional position. And the types of things they said was that they really learned to be independent, to take complete control of a project, to see it through to the end, and master something that they didn't know much about to begin with. And that this type of basic training and research applied to lots of skills out in the job market. So I think there may be an education value to the PhD that's not immediately obvious from the career choices that people make.
Well, first, I think it's really terrific that you all are keeping career data and that you can share that when many departments can't, okay? And I think that's really important. With regard to people saying how the skill set they got has really helped them, I hear that a lot also, but I also just wonder if we shouldn't ask if we couldn't teach those skill sets in a considerably shorter period of time and not at investing so much resources into it. I mean, I think it's terrific that the skill set's being used, but one has to wonder if there's a difference. And now in terms of consolidation, One of the interesting things is I've just looked at how NIH funds have been distributed over time. And one of the things that's pretty interesting is that the top institutions really hung on to their share during the, and at no other funding agency did the top institutions hang on to their share. NIH funding, the top institutions like Michigan, Harvard, et cetera, kept their share. And that's been pretty interesting, I think, and we haven't seen it with other funding agencies. So, okay.
Hi, so I would look at your data from a somewhat different point of view and say, we have a cadre of people who have developed an incredible amount of skill. They're very motivated. We're still a magnet from around the world for people to come here and do this work for, you know, for very little money and uncertain reward. And this is a pool of people who are a tremendous national asset, actually a tremendous global asset. And rather than, so this is something that the universities are actually doing very well. And rather than point the finger at the universities and blame us for overproducing too many of these incredibly skilled people, doesn't this call for a change on the part of society to increase the demand for these people rather than limiting the supply? You know, I would love to see a plot of, say, NSF budget or NASA budget as a function of GDP. You know, it's probably not going up.
No, it's
and
not.
I would say that's the problem.
Well,
you
I
know
don't.
This is, these are essential skills for the well-being.
Well,
of our society.
But it, you know, we passed the American Competes Act and we refused to fund the American Competes Act very much. Okay. Mm-hmm. And our society right now just doesn't seem to have an appetite to put a lot more money into research. But it's not just at the federal government or at the state government. I think there's a huge disconnect with industry now that really has been giving up basic research labs. And we see declines at DuPont. I mean, Bell Labs completely, you know, changed. So yes, I think, I mean, one of the ways to address this is to really increase demand for research and development.
That's what the countries that with rising economies.
Right, but you tell me, do you see that coming down the road right now? And it's not necessarily a reasonable policy to keep training people for something that our society doesn't seem willing to step up to the plate to do. Let's see, you had a question over here.
Hi, I have three questions. First is, why did you exclude the social sciences of your study? Second is, you are recommending higher salaries for postdocs, and I wonder what your recommendation is based in any kind of thing beyond good intentions, because in my view, market forces pushes for keeping these salaries low or even lower. So, and the third question is, you are painting a picture in which there is an increase in postdoc jobs for PhDs and a decrease in tenure-track jobs. And this clearly represents a deterioration of the quality of employment for PhDs in general. But my question is not this a general trend for all jobs that become less stable and more precarious? I see this across the board, not only for PhDs, but also for people without any university education and so on and so forth.
Okay, so with regard to why I didn't talk about social sciences, okay?
One of the things is when I started studying sciences years ago, I was very surprised that almost all my friends in economics and also in sociology thought that science was a lot like our field. You forgot about all the resources that you forgot about that. Tremendous expenses of our equipment and supplies and et cetera. And so when I set out to do this, and because of my experience of working with other NRCs, I decided to do this. Many of the same issues are there, but the resource issues are very different.
Is it a market for postdocs? Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I think that you can see that, at least in the biomedical sciences, it's not a market. It's a very NIH-administered market, okay? Everybody looks at what NIH does and follows exactly almost down to the dollar, okay? And so the third issue, there's an unlimited supply of foreign-born, of foreign PhD-educated people who will come for postdoc positions, which kind of puts downward pressure, definitely, on wages. But I think it's up to us, if we want to change the incentive structure, that we're going to have to think about the structure of pay in this market. Now, with regard to the fact that all of, that temporary jobs are becoming more and more important, I think that's definitely true. I can't argue with you about that. But I think the big issue here is that also just research jobs in the university, research jobs in general, are less likely given. And that's where my real concern is here.
Thank you for an interesting talk. There was an article in the American Interest, which was provocatively titled "The End of Higher Education as We Know It," and it talked about how VCs are funding disruptive higher education, things mm-hmm. such as Coursera, which U of M is involved with, right. Where professors teach online to thousands of students instead of just a few dozen at a time. And they speculated in this article that this might force a lot of universities out of business, because in engineering, for example, where I'm from, you know, students could take a lot of the math and chemistry and physics online and maybe just come to some campus 1 or 2 years for the lab component of their work to get their degrees. I was wondering if, you know, if that were to come to pass, if you thought about if that might be the driver that could separate the educational enterprise from the research enterprise, where if you're removing a large section of undergraduates from the bottom of that pyramid you showed, mm-hmm. and universities can't funnel tuition money into the research startup packages and so forth, if that could lead to consolidation of research into institutes, as you were saying, and take care of the problem in that manner that you perceive.
Well, it's possible, and I think we do see a lot of restructuring, but that an awful lot of what goes on in learning in science is of a tacit nature. You need the equipment,
you need to interact with people who are doing it.
And that element of training, at least right now, it's very hard to understand how that can be replaced by moving or those kind. Now,
it could be the amount of time people spend on campus.
I seem to have lost my mind, et cetera.
Okay. But I don't
think it will change the need for hands-on learning, which is really some of the
time for one more question.
So you gave us some of your recommendations for changes to policy, but I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for people who are currently young scientists or PhD students.
Well, I think Sally gave you some very good recommendations in terms of what she said. I think one of the things I'm really impressed with is when I talk to students and to postdocs, when they start making an inventory of the skills they have and what they're learning in their programs that are very transferable to other things. Okay?
That does not necessarily
mean I'm encouraging you to transfer out.
But I
think it is true that you do learn a lot of skills that are highly rewarded in the market in these programs.
One of the
things that I'm continually amazed at is
no matter
where I go
and talk, people complain that the people that they're hiring can't write and they can't communicate. They don't have soft skills. Okay? So it's really important to develop soft
skills, I think, and to
they seem to be rewarded more out there than we might like. I was just doing
interviews
at Caltech. One of the highly successful professors on the postdoc, who had
a huge number of applicants
on the basis of their social skills, because
networking was extremely important in his lab. And if he was going to bring you in as a postdoc, he wanted to be sure you could network, okay?
And so I think
learning those skills and learning how to communicate those and how to network in them.
Okay, thank you very much.